Good afternoon and welcome back to the podcast to be named later, the official podcast of Outfield Fly Rule. I'm here with Brent Blackwell.
Hi, it's good to be back.
Good to be back. It is September 18th, about a year from the last time we recorded.
Yeah.
We've sort of had stuff going on. For those that don't know, a year ago to today, I got very ill and was put into the hospital and had a lot of stuff going on. And then in the meantime, Brent's had some personal stuff going on. He got married. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
And, you know, the Braves have not helped contribute to wanting to jump back on the microphone sometimes. So,
yeah, but not really.
We're back and we're going to get back into the swing of things and start bringing you more Braves news on a weekly basis and maybe even more often. We've got some guests lined up and we have some additional Outfield Fly Rule writers who are going to be joining us in the near future. And we should be joined by Tommy Poe from Walk Off Walk here in the near future. So tune in. If you haven't listened before, give us a listen and you can subscribe at the iTunes near you. But here we go. Episode 22, the reboot.
Yeah, and this is our first ever remote episode where we are not sitting across a table from each other.
That was the other part. We had to figure out technology because neither one of us are technological geniuses. So that was a large part of it. But a lot of stuff's been going on since we last spoke. I guess we could go over a year's worth of stuff, but most of that's been covered in articles. People have been reading. People have been keeping track of the Braves, even if we haven't been giving them the info. But one of the things that's been coming up in a lot of discussion in the most recent past has been Brian Snitker and whether or not the Braves are going to keep him. As you know, he has a 2018 option. The team has a 2018 option for Snitker to return as a manager, and it hasn't been picked up yet. At this point in the past, the Braves had already picked up an option for Freddie Gonzalez, but it's kind of telling that maybe the Snitker option hasn't been picked up yet.
Yeah, is it normal for managers to be still in limbo at this point in the season? I feel like this normally happens in like August at the latest, but maybe I'm
wrong. Thinking that was the timing on the Freddie Gonzalez option when it was picked up. But it seems to me that at this point, you either know you're going to go with a different manager or you know you're going to keep the guy you're with. And I always felt like, at least in my opinion, Snitker was always just a placeholder manager. I mean, the team was, you know, the team reacted to him, but the front office, they only gave him a 1-1 deal, you know, 1 year guaranteed with a 1 year option. That's not a whole lot of confidence in a manager, or doesn't seem to be giving a whole lot of confidence in a manager. And, you know, the fact that they haven't picked up the option now, you know, seems to be one of those things that you could probably read something into it if you were trying to do so.
Right.
The options, I believe Major League Baseball Trade Rumors had a story via John Heyman not too long ago that said the Braves were considering their managerial options for 2018. And, you know, right now, I guess your options are clearly Snitker's an option for 2018, since he's under contract, at least for the moment. Then you've got...
Right. He's the Vegas favorite, I'm sure, exactly, at the moment.
But then you've got Ron Washington, a former major league manager at third base. You have Bo Porter, a former major league manager who is a special assistant to the GM. You have also in-house options like Terry Pendleton, who's been around a while. You have Eddie Perez, who has managerial experience in foreign leagues and has been around a while. Both of them have always been on the outside looking in as candidates for the Brave job. So, I mean, there's a lot of options there just with people who are in-house. That's not even considering, you know, options who are available outside of the Braves organization right now. You know, a Ron Gardenhire or somebody like that who's a proven manager. Yeah, I'm just mentioning names, not things we should have. But
I also don't think the Braves are the type to go looking outside of house for anything, which is frustrating. It's always been frustrating. But I figure if we do ditch Snitker, it'll be some other in-house solution because John Scherholtz and Bobby Cox don't want to extend their Rolodex too much. They don't want it to grow too much more than it already is.
Yeah, both of them still hold significant sway. You know, but Bo Porter and even Ron Washington, even though they're in-house because they're under contract now, would you consider them, you know, Braves in-house personnel? Or would you consider them people who are under the influence of Bobby Cox or John Scherholtz the same way a Pendleton or a Perez were?
Certainly not the same way. But at this point, I think of them as in-house just because they've kind of had to, they've kind of had some time in Atlanta. And so management would know if they fit whatever their idea of the Braves way is. I think they would have a good idea of that which, by the way, I think is ridiculous. But anyway, I've seen how this front office operates in that regard, and if they go with a surprising, innovative hire, it will be the first. In at least in terms of clubhouse.
Bo management. Porter seems to be one. We were talking about this before we went on the air. If the Braves are trying to set up for another run similar to the 90s, Bo Porter kind of seems like that option who would fit age-wise. I mean, he's right about the same age that Bobby Cox was when Cox went back down to the dugout, when he left the GM position and went back down to the dugout, early 50s. Late 40s, early 50s. He's a guy you could leave in that spot for 15 years, assuming he's successful. You're not going to leave somebody unsuccessful there for 15 years. But he's a guy you could leave there for 15 years and have some stability throughout that run. You know, Ron Washington he'll be, what, 65 next year? Snicker's 61. You know, at that age, are those the guys that you're going to be looking forward to a little bit of stability from in the future? I mean, I think if you hire either one of those guys, you're going to be looking to make another managerial hire in 4 years. You know, it makes me question whether they are a fit just, you know, chronologically.
Yeah, I don't know how much for me that matters, but it might. I also, who knows with this front office, who knows what they factor in when it comes to managerial choices. So that's
another name that I've seen thrown out by a good contingent of Braves fans is a guy who is outside of the managerial reruns, the manager, you know, rehashing the managers is Mark DeRosa. I've seen DeRosa's name being thrown around as a potential managerial candidate for not just the Braves job, but other jobs. Apparently he is versed enough on analytics to pay attention to him, but he still maintains that traditional mindset that the players like to have, and being a player himself, former player himself, you know, you would think that they would tend to gravitate towards him a little bit. So that's one name that I've seen. What would you think about a guy like that? You know, an outside the box type hire.
That's interesting. I'm certainly interested in it. It's one of those where until you see what the strategy is, you don't really know, but I don't have a problem if the front office decides to go in that direction. I don't really have a problem with it. I'm also of the opinion where managers don't really have a huge impact. I think they can have a positive or a negative impact over time, but I don't think a good manager this year could turn the 2017 Braves into a playoff team. So, it's not the most important decision the team makes, in my opinion, but it certainly matters a little bit. It's just a difference of opinion as to how much it matters, I guess.
A manager's most important job is putting the right players on the field at the time and putting them in a position to succeed. And I believe, I don't know if you remember, but when the season first started, I started a spreadsheet called Snickering Away Victories, where I kept track of all of his,
I recall that.
All of his not so bright moves, which included, you know, usage of certain relievers in bad situations or certain pinch hitters who shall remain nameless, Bonifacio, to, you know, come up in key positions in key situations. And it just reached a point where I quit keeping track of it because it was happening quite often. But yeah, I agree. Generally speaking, a good manager is going to get you 3 or 4 wins a year. A bad manager might cost you 4 or 5 wins a year, but generally it's going to be based on the talent on the field. And a lot of times the manager doesn't have any control over that. So
I feel like managers are more likely to lose your games than win you games. It feels like it's just the glaring bad decisions are so more obvious than, they seem to happen so much more frequently than a manager outfoxing another one. It's not exactly like football where really good strategy can just, you know, baffle your opponent. Instead, just bad strategy baffles your fans.
A couple of weeks ago, there was an interview done during a game. As a matter of fact, John Hart was in the broadcast booth during a game, and he pretty much said, or he didn't out and out say it, but he indicated that Snitker had not done anything to lose the job, and he was happy with the way Snitker had performed. And it kind of gave the impression that Brian Snitker was going to be back next year. But since that interview, A couple of stories have come out saying that they've kind of backed off of that a little bit, that the team has not performed as well as they thought they should be doing. And also it was pointed out that a couple of people in the front office, of course, they're anonymous and will remain nameless, have indicated that they weren't particularly happy with the way Snitker was using a struggling Jim Johnson in key situations. And that caused them to step back and question it. So if somebody were to ask me, you know, a month ago or 2 months ago, I thought that Ron Washington was probably the leading candidate to be the Braves opening day manager in 2018. But now I think it's probably closer to 50-50 between him and Bo Porter, if somebody were to ask me. I don't have a preference of one over the other. I'm just saying that I think that that's just what I feel right now, that those are the two leading candidates. I think Snitker probably is in the mix. I mean, you clearly got to have him in the mix.
Sure. If it's not Snitker, I think I think between Porter or Washington, I think I might prefer Porter, just because we've seen what Washington had. Some really good teams in Texas, like really good teams that were put together by John Daniels, and Washington had some bad strategy with really, really good teams. Bo Porter had bad strategy too, but it was with a team that was designed to fail. So I can kind of understand why a manager might do something more desperate and might try more sacrifice bunts, more maybe suboptimal stolen base attempts. Because the Houston Astros that Bo Porter had were a team that was designed to secure them another number one draft pick the following year. And so I can understand why Bo Porter, in a desperate attempt to win games with really bad players, probably, I mean, they probably had, I'm
and
curious
both of those players, while you look that up, both of those managers come with baggage too. I mean, Washington, clearly, you know, he was let go from Texas for his personal reasons. I mean, there's no need to rehash that. But in Houston, Bo Porter was said to kind of have not even said, I mean, it was pretty clear that Bo Porter and Jeff Lunau, the general manager, did not get along with each other, which is kind of ironic considering that Lunau hired him and said, "This is my guy." But it reached a point where the two just couldn't stand being around each other. And you know, generally in that case, Bo Porter went to the owner, as a matter of fact, and said, "Hey, this guy needs to quit second guessing me." And when you do that, the guy that has the higher rank generally comes out ahead. So, you know, if Porter did have issues, maybe he learned from those, learned how to better manage that. So maybe that's something that, you know, he can learn from. But both of them have their own baggage. Terry Pendleton, you know, kind of an outside candidate as well. You know, he used to be, his name was always mentioned when managerial jobs came up as recently as, you know, 3-4 years ago. Now, all of a sudden, his name is not out there as much. I wonder if something has come to light, or if, you know, teams have just kind of soured on him for some reason. And then I've always liked Eddie Perez. I just like Eddie Perez. So if he gets the job, I have nothing to say because I like him.
With Pendleton, I wonder if he just interviews poorly, because he seems to have gotten a lot of interviews over the years for managerial jobs. And
well, video of him chucking one of his employees around the dugout probably didn't help matters, but I can't hold that against him because, you know, I wasn't particularly a Chris Johnson fan.
It was
right.
So, I was about to say it was Chris Johnson.
But yeah, the Braves have a glut of managerial candidates if they decide to make a move. There's obviously no indication yet that they've decided to make a move, other than the fact that the option has not yet been picked up. Will they do anything to make a change? Who knows? But I just think it's kind of telling that the option hasn't been picked up at this point.
Yeah, perhaps so. Although if it were me well, first off, if it were me making the decisions, right, I wouldn't be limited to those three choices. But if those are our three choices, honestly, I'm kind of fine just letting Snitker manage again next year. Because, like you said, Porter's was a bit of a disaster with management. Now, granted, when he was brought in, he was, I don't know if baseball, that was 6 years ago, I think, when his first year managing Houston. Maybe not even that long. Maybe it's 4 or 5 years ago. But I don't know if baseball analytics, while analytics had definitely permeated every front office in the game, I don't know if that was quite into the clubhouses the way it is now. Like now, a ton of players focus on advanced stats and analytics. And he might be a little more accustomed to the newer evolving culture of baseball clubhouses than he was when he was put in charge of a clubhouse whose GM wanted them to focus on those things. So Porter might be better in a second run, and maybe he's learned from his mistakes, but that's why I think he has more upside than Washington. But still, I wouldn't be thrilled about either one, and I wouldn't be thrilled with keeping Snitker either, but apparently, those are the choices that the Braves
are. So the official OFR vote of confidence goes to either Mark DeRosa or Eddie Perez, correct?
I mean, right. Which is basically the same as the official. It's just like giving it to a robot or a jar of mayonnaise. I don't know. They're all the same to me, because I don't know what Eddie Perez brings to the table other than just maybe hopefully not being
maybe the Braves should just hire that octopus that Ron picks Washington. The World Cup winners every 4 years and just give him a lineup card to choose from every time and see what happens. He seems to do a good job with the World Cup.
Honestly, if you just let the maybe like a fan vote on who should be starting, I wonder if fans could just do a better job
crowdsourcing.
Actually,
the starting
that's probably
lineup.
Not
yeah,
true.
Yeah, I've seen some of our lineup options that have been mentioned in some of the various Facebook groups around the intertubes. Yeah, let's not crowdsource the lineup.
Yeah, that was a bad call. That was a bad call on my part. I'm probably not going to edit that out, but if I were vain, I totally would.
Managerial spots are not the only spot that there seems to be a glut of candidates for. Right now, it looks like in 2018, there are going to be quite a few outfield candidates as well for the Braves. We've obviously got Markakis and Kemp on the corners. We've got Ender Inciarte locked down in center field. We have Lane Adams, who seems to be playing himself into at least a fourth outfielder spot. And then, of course, there's the phenom, Ronald Acuna, making his way up the system. Whether he starts the season as a Brave, an Atlanta Brave, or whether he starts, you know, in one of the minor league spots, likely Gwinnett, in order to hold down service time, who knows? But the fact is Ronald Acuna is very likely to be an Atlanta Brave next year. A lot of talk about who gets moved to make room for him. Does Matt Kemp get moved? Does Nick Markakis get moved? Do players get moved around? Is there a rotation or a platoon? I can say this much. Ronald Acuna is not going to come up and sit on the bench. Lane Adams, as well as he's been playing, probably profiles as a really good fourth outfielder. Really good fourth outfielder the way he's been playing right now. He could possibly even be a better starting option than Nick Markakis as well, but definitely than Matt Kemp. When you look at the overall contributions from defense, stolen bases, base running, offense, the question is, can he maintain that? He's doing really well right now in his limited playing time. Is that something sustainable over, you know, extended playing time? If you were looking at this Braves offense or this Braves outfield, what do you think the likelihood of Kemp or Markakis being moved to make room for an Acuna would be?
The likelihood that either one is moved, I would say is 70%. I would be surprised if both are in the opening day lineup in 2018. Just my gut tells me that they'll move Kemp.
Need to move
because
Kemp.
They just he like brings Markakis. Yeah, and Kemp is. The last year
he
of
has
Markakis'
one year,
contract coming up
left?
Okay, so Kemp screws up 2019 plans as long as he's on the roster, whereas Markakis doesn't, even if you keep him. And that's why I think Kemp has to be priority number one. He's also the worst player. He's also, a statue in the field. My apologies to statues. And Kemp, he's also the hitting has tailed off too. He's
right.
Not
you
the
could get by
year,
with his poor.
He's been in recent years.
Right, you can get by with his poor defense injuries. When he was hitting at a 900 OPS clip and clubbing, 28, 30 home runs a year. You could get by with worst in-game defense out there as long as he was doing that. Now that he's not doing that, whether that be because of injury or poor performance or whatever, you kind of have to look at, okay, if he's not giving me defense and he's not giving me offense, what is he giving me? Because clearly he's not giving me anything on base running. He's not stealing bases. He's not, he's not providing value anywhere. And he's not providing any of that value at $21.5 million a year. So at some point, you have to step back and say, okay, what value can he provide? Well, he does have value to an AL team as a DH and a part-time left fielder. I mean, his bat does still hold some power, and power is one of those things that traditionally doesn't regress with age as much as the other hit tools do. So it's something that he could still maintain his power for the next couple of years of that contract. And since he's not having to play the field, still brings some positive impact to an AL team. We would probably have to pay down that salary a good bit. I mean, he's due $43 million over the next 2 years.
Yeah.
I would imagine we would have to pay down half or more of that. Yeah. I
was thinking the same thing. 25 to 30 million.
Because he's just not worth that minimum. Now. But at the same time, if we can do that, that clears up a roster space. It clears up some salary relief. Even if we pay down a good bit of it, that still gives us some salary relief to go and target somebody else. So, you know, if we pay down $10 million a year for the next 2 years for that, that still clears $10 million a year off the books, $11 million a year off the books. So that's something that they could still use to go and target someone else. I think Markakis, he's worth what he's done. I mean, since I was looking at it earlier, since 2015 when he got here, Markakis has been worth 3.4 F-War since he's been in Atlanta. And they've paid him $33 million over that period of time. That's right at the average value. I mean, 3.4 F-War at roughly 8 to 9 million a year in WAR. That's going to be right at about $29, $30 million. So he's not been significantly overpaid for what he's provided. I do think that... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Baseball Prospectus has him higher than that even. Since the start of his contract, they've got him at 5.2.
million per win, he's still providing value, right?
It's more eight these days. Yeah, so he's been worth $40 million since we acquired him. It's just a matter of the real only remaining question with Markakis is just that if you're planning to lose for 2 or 3 years, why have him at all? But if you get past that, at least he has.
There was a story out just within the last day or two as well that said that the Braves see his $10.5 million as roughly a fair market value for him, and I don't disagree with that. I think his salary for 2018 is pretty accurate. I mean, or not accurate. I'm sorry, is pretty fair as a reflection of his value. He doesn't bring a lot in terms of power. He does hit some doubles, but I mean, his ISO and his slugging are both relatively low, especially for the position that he plays. He doesn't bring a lot of value in terms of speed or base running. He's a smart base runner and he's a good base runner, but he doesn't bring excess value by virtue of speed. And then, you know, his defense, you can argue whether it's good, bad, indifferent, whether defensive metrics properly value him or not, but he makes the plays he's supposed to make, and that has value. So I'm not the biggest thing for me for Markakis is I really dig the 360 OBP. I mean, getting on base leads to runs, and even if it's a single at a time or a walk at a time, you got to have base runners in order to score runs, and that's one thing he does well.
Yeah, I definitely think Markakis is more useful than Kemp by a long shot. But I think when it comes to the outfield, the story of the offseason is going to be which one gets moved. Will the Braves be able to move Kemp in a way that works for them? Although I would be completely fine moving both, honestly. That being said, I won't be upset if Markakis is still on the roster.
Yeah, exactly. I think Kemp is the one you have to target the move for. I think he's also going to be the hardest one to move, clearly, just because of salary. We'll see. I mean,
yeah.
There's nothing.
You're losing that trade.
I really, all things considered, they probably should have not traded for him to begin with and just saved that money and targeted someone as a free agent rather than trading for him. But they were kind of in a PR hit with the Hector Olivera situation. They didn't make matters any better by the way they tried to sell the contract at the time by saying, you know, that he's only $9 million when the fact is the checks that he receives are $21 million. So you know, there's been a lot of confusion about how much money Matt Kemp is paid by the Braves. It's really not that difficult. The Braves pay Matt Kemp $21.5 million a year. That's what they pay him. Now, how much is out of their pocket depends on how you calculate the money that the San Diego Padres sent over. The Dodgers aren't paying him anything.
Well, really, it's all of it is out of our pocket. Our pockets just got a little deeper thanks to the San Diego's contributions.
When the Dodgers sent him to San Diego, they sent a pile of cash, and that ended the Dodgers' involvement with Matt Kemp. He was done with them. They're no longer involved with him after they sent him to the Padres. So then the Padres had him on payroll. They paid his salary using not just their money, but also money that the Dodgers sent. And then they traded him to the Braves. And when they traded him to the Braves, they sent cash with that deal. He's not on the payroll of multiple teams. He's not getting money and checks from the Padres and the Dodgers and the Braves. He's getting one check from the Braves for X amount of dollars. That X is $21.5 million. How the Braves chose to use the $10.5 million that the Padres sent over, they may have used it all as one lump sum. They may have amortized it over 3 years, which is how it's typically calculated. But the money went into the account, and then it was spent. So the Braves are writing checks for $21.5 million, regardless of how you calculate how you get to that figure. That's what he's made. So a team acquiring him is going to have to pay him $21.5 million a year for his services, and I don't see a team in baseball willing to do that.
Which is why Atlanta's going to have to do what LA did and San Diego did. They're going to have to
attach a really, really valuable asset to him, like we did with BJ Upton and Craig Kimbrell. And I think they learned from that lesson. I think they would rather just send the cash, because the cash is a one-time hit. You're done with it, and then you can move on. The cash doesn't have to come back and pitch against you in future years. So I think, you know, moving Matt Kemp is one of those things that the Braves need to really prioritize. The problem is who do you send him to? Clearly, you limit your choices by making it an AL team simply because of the DH. And then when you look at the teams, the AL teams that have the payroll to take on something, even if you're paying down half of it, you know Tampa Bay is not going to take on a $10 million DH. You know Oakland's not going to take on a $10 million DH. You know, you start eliminating small market teams. You know, Kansas City's not going to take him on. You know, you start eliminating teams, and that leaves you with the same ones, you know, the major contenders every year, the Yankees. Now, you mentioned earlier that the Yankees could possibly be a fit.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to see how the Yankees looked at with DH this year, and it wasn't great. I think they had brought in Chris Carter to start the year, and that was a disaster. Greg Bird has been a disaster for the Yankees, so there's potential. Now, granted, if I'm the Yankees, I'm trying to upgrade DH, and I'm not looking Matt Kemp to do that. That's the problem the Braves are going to run into. But so we're going to have to really make it a sweet deal for the Yankees. And maybe part of that comes with trading for Chase Headley, perhaps, because the Yankees they acquired a great third base prospect who's sitting in AAA from the Cubs in the Aroldis Chapman trade in 2016. And, you know, maybe the Yankees are looking to move Headley out of the way. Headley hasn't been bad, but he hasn't been great. And I don't think there's too much remaining on his deal. So that could be something of a...
And it creates room
we'll
for both.
Take your bad contract if you take ours.
And something of use for both, because the Braves could use, depending on how things play out, could use a third baseman. And Chase Headley was at one point a good third baseman, or at least for a couple of years was a good third baseman. And he could play multiple positions.
He's still all right.
He's second base as well. Not that we need a second baseman, but he's one of those guys that... If you had to spot start somebody, you could move him around if you wanted to keep his bat in, or he could come in as a defensive replacement for somebody. But, you know, Headley's one of those guys that might be an option for the Braves looking forward, you know, looking towards next year or even right now at this year, 2017, the Braves have a glut of infielders as well. Right now, the Braves have Rio Ruiz, Adonis Garcia, Johan Camargo, all of them playing on the left side of the infield. Dansby Swanson as well. They have Ozzy Albies. There's a lot of young infield talent that there's just not enough room to play all of them. Now, clearly, Ozzy Albies is going to play. You're not going to sit him and try and figure out what you have with him. You pretty much know what you have with him, and he's going to play. All right, stick him at second base. Dansby Swanson is very likely the second or the shortstop going forward. There's really not anything I've seen to say that he's not going to be the opening day shortstop in 2018. But with Rio Ruiz and Adonis Garcia and Johan Camargo, you really don't know what you have there in terms of third baseman. I think we know what Adonis Garcia is. I take that back. We know what he is. But he's on the roster and he's cheap. But Rio Ruiz hasn't shown a lot so far during his time in the big leagues. He's shown flashes for at-bats at a time, but nothing extended. Johan Camargo has just been raking and raking and raking. Granted, it's been BABIP enhanced. And as much as I would like to play it down, he keeps doing it. You know, as much as I would like to say, oh, this has got to regress at some point because his BABIP is 390, 440, whatever. At some point, yes, it has to regress, but it hasn't. So until it does, keep playing the guy. And he plays a great third base. He's got a great arm. He's plays smart too. He plays smart baseball when you see him out there. He's doing all the fundamental things. So that's a good thing as well. That's three young guys over there. Well, two young guys and a Garcia over there that at some point you have to figure out what you have in them. Are they capable of handling the job full time? Do you platoon them or do you try and bring in a guy like a Chase Headley for a 1 or 2 year stopgap until your third baseman of the future, whoever that is, Austin Riley or whomever, is ready to play? Do you go after a Chase Headley for a stopgap or do you platoon those guys?
I mean, I've seen,
right.
I don't know. With Garcia, I'm done with Garcia. Garcia is worthless. Garcia, we need to get rid of Garcia. When it comes to Camargo, I think Camargo's ideal position is as a utility player, somebody who can give days off to Albies, give days off to Swanson, play even some outfield, be a Martin Prado light, at least until he can prove to me that he can become Martin Prado on a regular basis. But I'm perfectly willing to say that the Camargo's BABIP is not sustainable and we don't need to like plan our future around it. I think bringing in a Headley, and first off, let me preface, I don't know that the Yankees are going to want to trade Headley. He's had a good year this year, actually, and for some reason, I was still thinking of him more in his 2016 tense, which was a 253 hitter with, you know, 15 home runs or so, but this year, Headley has, he's been a better hitter, and I think as a result, the Yankees, the price tag for Headley is going to go up. With only a year remaining on his contract, he would be, the Yankees will owe him $13 million next year, but we would owe him $14 million if traded. So it's a, the price tag might be too high for us to pursue him, but you never know. The Yankees may choose to, they may see their prospect and think, let's move Headley, bring this guy up and use that $13 million elsewhere and stabilize the, I don't know, the,
well, it would help them to honestly, get rid of his salary just for luxury tax calculation really purposes, because the new CBA really hammers teams who are paying the luxury tax. It affects their draft pick compensation, yeah, all of that stuff for qualified offers and whatnot. And because of the way it calculates multiple time offenders of the luxury tax, I've been reading more and more that the Yankees are going to try and push to get below the luxury tax so that that new calculation doesn't hammer them as hard. But, you know, not that I'm not saying Headley's somebody we should target. You just mentioned him as, hey, this might be a fit. And coincidentally, you know, the Braves could use a third baseman. You know, I like the idea of platooning the two young guys at third base next year, just to see, that gives us a chance to play both of them for an extended period of time to see what they have. And both of them are cheap, so it's not going to cost a lot of money to play them. The worst thing that can happen is that they are a below average third baseman. Well, guess what we've had for the last 3 years at third base? Below average third baseman. So it's not going to put us any further back. Best thing that can happen is we know that they're going to be, well, we don't know. I think it's very reasonable to suspect that a platoon of Camargo and Ruiz are going to be better than Adonis Garcia. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. So we would probably see an increase in production there for, you know, very minimal amounts of money. If you go and you target a free agent or a trade for a guy who's making $7, $8, $10, $12, $15 million, that's going to affect your ability to go and upgrade in other places if you were looking to upgrade in other areas. Also, having that cheap option makes it easier to buy down and eat a little bit of a contract like a Matt Kemp. It's a lot easier to eat $10 million if you're not having to pay $10 million somewhere else on the diamond. I don't know. The Braves have a lot of infielders. They have a lot of options. I do like the idea of at least looking at the market. I don't think Mike Moustakas as a free agent is going to be an option for multiple reasons. One, he's going to have free agent compensation attached. He's going to have a qualifying offer this year. He's going to receive a qualifying offer, and so that's going to cost the Braves their third highest draft pick. So I don't think that's really an option. That's before you even get to how much the actual salary is going to be. That's just going to be the cost to sign him. And we know that Coppola and Hart like acquiring draft picks rather than getting rid of them. So I just don't see that as a viable option. Some of the other guys that are out there, Todd Frazier, same thing. Todd Frazier, I believe, was he traded this year? That's right. So he won't get a qualifying offer. He's still going to get a decent salary. He's still going to get
a qualifying offer.
$45 million offer. So, I don't see the Braves doing that. So they probably are going to stick with in a platoon or some option of Camargo and Ruiz. I'm not necessarily heavily sold on Ruiz. I think he's probably a platoon candidate at best. I don't think he's an everyday third baseman. I don't think Camargo's an everyday third baseman. I think he's a platoon candidate as well, utility guy. But if you can platoon the two of them and get this mega hybrid third baseman for cheap, go ahead and do that. Take advantage of both of their strengths. There's no rule that says you have to have an everyday starter that's the same guy every single day at a position. If you can get a platoon that gives you better production than a single guy over there and everybody's happy with it, do it. And I think those guys would be happy playing, showing what they can do.
Right. Yeah. It's the only thing is, I know teams generally don't like to, they don't like to carry multiple third basemen on the roster. They like for their backup or their platoon guy at third to be capable of playing short, second, basically be a utility guy. Like Camargo, I suppose would fit that. But, my guess is Camargo would be playing.
Ruiz would pay more than Ruiz is big against right-handers. So, 60% of the batter of the pitchers they face are righties. So I would imagine Ruiz would be getting the bulk of that playing time.
Well, maybe it could work. It might work then. I don't know. I really believed in Rio Ruiz as a prospect. And after seeing him some, I just don't believe in him quite as much as a major league contributor anymore. But what did he, I'm looking up, I'm going to see what he did.
Got a little bit of, I believe it was
not
when
good
he was
at major league level.
First acquired him and he first came over. There was a lot of talk about him. But he was playing in, if I remember, it was either the PCL or the California League. He was playing in one of those high-octane, West Coast environments in the minors. And he was putting up good numbers there. But people weren't accounting for the fact that it was BABIP-driven and it was in a high-offense environment. It's like, if you have a guy who goes and puts up numbers in Colorado, the first thing people say is, oh, that's Colorado. Well, the same can be said for a lot of the stadiums in both the PCL and I believe the other one is the California League, maybe in the Northwest League, I can't recall, where the offense is significantly higher in those leagues because of elevation and because of park configurations and things like that.
I think it's inflated in both, but he definitely wasn't in the PCL because that's AAA, and I don't think he had reached AAA.
He's shown flashes. He at times strikes out a lot, and then at times he walks a lot. He never really has shown, I don't think, the power that teams like to see from third baseman. You can argue whether, a team is right in saying, okay, we want to get our home runs from our right fielder and our third baseman and our first baseman. We want to get our stolen bases from our center fielder and middle infield. Get them where you can get them. But some teams still subscribe to that, okay, he plays this position, so he needs to give us this philosophy. And for that, I don't think Ruiz is necessarily a good fit at third base. He strikes me as a second baseman hitter, miscast as a third baseman playing.
Right. And the reason they have those preconceptions is because you don't typically get the defense isn't as important at the corners. And so
and availability
where the defense isn't as important, you want to get big offense. And so I think Ruiz is, yeah, and Ruiz is not bad defensively. I don't think he's going to ever win a Gold Glove or anything at third, but I think he's passable at third. But, well, sure, I am too. But, but yeah, Rio,
right?
It's you need to be Brooks Robinson for his offense to really stand at third. For me, I don't mind having Rio Ruiz in the system, and I don't even I don't hate the idea of having him as your AAA backup. But I would prefer the team, especially if they are serious about their plans. Right.
He's not a guy
to
you typically you're going to see.
I would prefer the team to try to be better manning third the hot corner next year.
He may be the guy they call up when the guy you want manning the hot corner gets injured. No. But he's not typically the man, or at least what you would conceptualize as the man of a playoff team at the hot corner.
So again, I think I really hope our third baseman, our starting third baseman on opening day next year is not currently in the Atlanta organization. That's my outlook.
I could agree with that.
That's the main acquisition.
I don't necessarily agree that you're a better third baseman than Adonis Garcia, but I can agree with your assessment of the rest. That's not the only spot that the Braves have been talking about looking at upgrading. We've also seen some talk about or some questions about when the Braves should go after some pitching. The pitching this year, especially the starting pitching, well, in the bullpen, have been, crappy, less than stellar. There's been some talk that the Braves may go after a frontline starter or a top of rotation starter this year, whether that be via trade. I can't see them do it in a free agency. Free agency just is free agent pitchers are significantly overpriced. And when I say overpriced, I mean the market pays what the market pays. But when you look at you end up paying a guy for what he did in a different environment with different teams around him, with different supporting cast. And I don't think that's the best way to necessarily build your team. Some guys you know are going to be good regardless, so you pay them. You know, the David Prices. David Price got his money because he's a good pitcher, regardless of what his supporting cast is. But when you look at the list of guys available now, you know, the Alex Cobbs or whoever, are they really that kind of pitcher, or are they a function of the people around them? And you look at who some of the free agent pitchers are going to be. Yu Darvish is going to be a free agent. Masahiro Tanaka is likely to opt out, or I say likely, he's got an opt-out option. Who are going to be the main frontline pitchers available versus in free agency versus who you can go out and get? I still think the Braves have some interest in Michael Fulmer up in Detroit and probably even in Chris Archer. Now that the Rays are going to be out of a playoff race come the end of the season, they may still revisit the idea of going after Chris Archer. When do you think the Braves should make a move towards a top of the rotation starter?
So I always have two trains of thought on this, and they don't conflict with each other. But one is that if your window is open, overpay and go do it, because you know the Chicago Cubs, for example, can if they go into the tank in 3 years because they traded away all their best prospects a year ago, they're not going to care. They've got that flag. And if your window is open, try to win. And I have no problem with teams trying to do that. Obviously, I don't want them to completely sell the entire farm system to do so. But if the window is open, I definitely like the idea of overpaying a little bit. That being said, there's no indication that our window is open right now, that our window for a championship is open. I think some optimism could get us there, but that's really all it is optimism. Maybe it's based in some, you know, realistic sense, but it's still optimistic when we say that, you know, we're going to have Luis Gohara or Lucas Sims or whoever, pick out any young player that you like, or that Dansby Swanson will be in his prime. I think it's very likely that Dansby Swanson will be a key contributor to a good team while he's in his prime, but it's not evident in the same way that Corey Seager is in Los Angeles. And so I think for now we make that trade if that trade is just a good trade for us. And that's the only reason you make it. The only reason you make it is if you could get good value right now. if the young players and if the young core of this team start really building towards something special, at that point, I could see overpaying for Chris
Michael
Archer.
Fulmer
I could
see overpaying available. And there's always guys, too. I mean, Sonny Gray and Jose Quintana may still be available. I mean, just because they were traded this past trade deadline doesn't mean the teams acquiring them are going to hold on to them for the remainder of their contracts. I mean, any player can be had if you're willing to go and offer the right deal for it.
Sure. But from those teams' perspectives, whether you're the Yankees or the Cubs, or even if you're the Rays,
right,
you're probably, or the Tigers, you only trade those guys if you get a really good return. And if some team is willing to overpay, I don't know why the White Sox probably made the right call trading Quintana to the Cubs, because the Cubs, their window being open now, were more willing to overpay for Quintana than the Braves were, a team that was acquiring him as much for 2019 as they were for 2017. So Atlanta probably wasn't willing to pay as much as the Cubs were, for good reason. And the Cubs were willing to pay more for good reason, because Quintana might help them win a second championship to like this year. And so I think for now, until our window comes open through a more organic nature, like homegrown players really putting together something, maybe not great, but just more competitive than they currently are. Because what I don't want to see is us turn into the AJ Preller Padres, which was a team that thought, we've got some young guys, we can force our window open, and so let's go trade for Craig Kimbrell. Let's go trade for Justin Upton. Let's go trade for...
Didn't they also sign James Shields, too?
Oh, let's go trade for Matt Kemp. And that set that franchise back, doing that.
Yeah, I...
Oh, yeah. Signed him to a big contract.
With the window, I agree. If the window's open, you go get you somebody who can get you through that window, who can boost you into it. But I don't see that situation for the Braves right now. I think they're probably at least a year away from that window being big enough to try and squeeze a body through. Right now, we're still trying to accumulate the pieces to get in position to kind of go after the window, to go after that. I think we could be an outside wild card team next year if everything happened exactly right. I think more likely next year is probably, I thought this year they were going to be close to a 75 win team. I think next year they'll probably be closer to a 500 team. You know, a lot of that is dependent on who they get to fill some of these holes, as well as who is, you know, which guys take steps forward, which guys take steps back. But I think realistically, as far as competing for a playoff spot where, okay, this is our chance. And you have two different windows too. You have window for a playoff spot. You know, can we get into the wild card, or can we get into a cheap division victory? And then you also have the window for the World Series. You can make the playoffs without making the World Series, but you can't make the World Series without making the playoffs. At some point, you know, there's two different runs you have to make there. And I think the Braves' first window clearly is making the playoffs. And then the second one, that's probably a year or two before they are ready to make a World Series run. I think they're probably closer to a World Series run, assuming everything, you know, plans out, you know, plays out the right way. They're probably closer to that around 2021.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I think of what the Astros did. And, you know, you remember like 3 years ago, the Astros had that surprise season where they were good way earlier than they expected to be. And their window kind of was starting to come open at that point. And they didn't go overboard. They didn't go trade for, I hope I'm remembering this right, at least. They didn't go trade for, they didn't deal a bunch of their prospects for a top name player. They waited until their prospects, their core strengthened. The players they had got a little more reliable. And they were able to figure out, okay, we're going to stick with this guy. We're going to stick with this guy. We're going to stick with this guy. And at that point, prospects became a little more available to be dealt. And this year is the year the Astros are really making their push, because this year is the year their window is truly open. And so that's why they go out and get Justin Verlander. I know Verlander isn't, I mean, he's good. He's still very
reliable.
But he's
better than an option.
He's not quite the same name as Archer or a Chris Sale or somebody like that. But sure. Yes. And so I think that's that's kind of what I want to see us do, because by the time we really need a frontline starter, as in a frontline starter is the difference between us winning the division and fighting for a wild card spot. By the time we need a frontline starter, Mike Soroka may be one. Colby Allard might be one. And so I don't know. I don't know why we would do that now. The Carlos Quintana trade interest always baffled me a little bit, because a lot of the interest in him seemed to be focused around the fact that he was signed for 2019. And I thought, what I kept coming back to is, if he can't turn us into a contender in 2017, why is he a better choice now for 2019 than some guy who we could just acquire in late 2018 or just before 2019? And so it seems, it's like paying a free agent to help you win 2 years down the road. There's going to be other free agents. There will be other players. You never bet on a pitcher 3 years from now unless he helps you right now, is my philosophy.
And they're so subject to injury. Pitchers I think, are 40% more likely to hit the DL.
Pitchers don't stay
great. The last numbers I saw, 40% more likely to hit a DL than a position player. And, you know, when they do, they hit the DL for longer. You know, obviously, you know, there's individual situations. Some guys are more injury prone than others. Some guys are less injury prone than others. Mechanics, this and that and the other. But I've always been a fan of developing your pitchers and buying your hitters if you're going to go that route. If you're going to spend on free agency, with the exception of, you know, the Clayton Kershaws when they become available, if you have the money to go after them, develop your pitchers, buy your hitters, or better yet, develop your hitters as well, and then buy your filler, you know. Go in and get your, you know, I don't know, your Lonnie Smith, the guy you just need to fill a spot here and there, your Otis Nixon, whoever you need to fill in a spot here and there, because you already have developed the pitchers and the hitters that you are going to make your run with. Fill in the chaff with the guys off the, you know, the free agency, you know, out of free agency, and use that to plug in the holes.
I wonder if Braves, hopefully management isn't this way, but I wonder if, as Braves fans, we are a little backwards when it comes to the best way to spend your dollars, because I agree with you. I think the best way, the smartest way to build a team is to spend big bucks on hitting and just develop so much pitching that something sticks. Because, like you said, I mean, pitching doesn't last. And so why would you commit hundreds of millions of dollars in future money to pitching when it is a significantly worse bet than hitting? Hitters tend to follow a more predictable aging curve. But I wonder if, as Braves fans, it's harder for us because we have been rewarded with paying big bucks to pitchers over the years. Right. And we have been just punished so severely for paying big bucks to hitters that we've brought in from outside the organization. B.J. Upton, Dan Uggla.
J.D. Drew is another one who's hated, but J.D. Drew had a
Mark
phenomenal season
was a
in his 1 year here. But because of all the hype of him coming in, and there's just this idea that he was terrible while he was here. J.D. Drew put up one of the best seasons ever by any Atlanta Brave. But, he was also not a likable guy, too.
Yeah, that's only because of Adam Wainwright. Right. Also, I think fans got upset when the hometown kid from Valdosta didn't want to take a cheap deal to stay here and instead got what he deserved and, you know, got paid by L.A. But that's beside the point. But we have been, it seems like we've been punished a lot by investing in hitters. And I think B.J. Upton is the big name that comes to mind with that. And even though that's the smart route to take, Braves fans may be a little backwards because for years we paid money to Greg Maddux and Tom Glavine and John Smoltz, and they all just aged remarkably well, and they were still, and so we might view pitching unrealistically.
Well, I think
and
the
we
Braves,
might view hitting
I hope the
as
Braves
unrealistically
don't
unreliable when
and,
it is more reliable.
Waste some of these picks or some of these prospects that they have just for the sake of getting a guy that they feel is a little bit better option than what they have now. I mean, I don't want the argument to be, but he's better than Dickey. Well, yeah, so are, you know, a lot of other freely available guys that we didn't have to give up anybody for. I'd rather them go after, you know, even Dickey. I would have preferred they take that $8 million a year or so average and put that into maybe another guy who has more upside. I mean, Dickey's done okay. He's given them innings, and that's really what he was – that's what he was brought in for. But quality innings is a good thing to have too.
Do you pick up Dickey's option for next year?
I think you could take –
It's $8 million. If you don't pick up Dickey's option, basically paying for
here's the way I look at it. It's all about allocation of resources. Dickey is $8 million. If you don't pick up his option and you just go with insert random call up, if you put Williams Perez, for example, in that spot, and I'm just using a name as somebody that the Braves can identify with, Braves fans can identify with, random call up in that spot, you're probably going to get a half to one WAR out of him. If he's anything close to functional, and you're going to get that for $500,000, that then gives you $7.5 million towards paying down Matt Kemp's contract that you can ship him out and get somebody. So I think the $8 million is more valuable to the Braves than the innings. I think you can get those innings from any number of people. Mike Minor is going to be a free agent. You know what? Go throw him. Well, that's assuming that the Royals don't pick up his option, which it's unlikely they're going to do. It's a $10 million option. He's also been thrown out of the bullpen, and he's a guy who, you know, he said he wouldn't
mind. I'm looking that up now because Mike Minor has been to the bullpen,
so it helped, you know, extend his career. That he prefers starting because he knows that he knows when he's going to pitch, and you don't get that stability with the bullpen, but he would be willing to do it. But it doesn't have to be Mike Minor. It could be anybody. I think you can take that $8 million and apply it to paying down Matt Kemp's contract and then plug in somebody else and get one WAR out of it.
Sure. Yeah, hand the keys to a rookie or something, just somebody like that. Just like make Lucas Sims let him take that spot in the rotation for good or whatever. Yeah, I agree. Well, Dickey has a $500,000 buyout, so it's really a $7.5 million decision.
Yeah, it's been a year since we've done this, so a little bit of rust. I'm getting back into it. So I hear you're doing another podcast, that you're a guest on another podcast about movies and such.
Yeah, it's the Talky Talk podcast from themediabias.com.
Pop culture stuff.
We talk about movies, TV, also, video games occasionally.
And Dylan Short, just, I don't know, things we like Outfield Firewall, has his podcast as well, the Shell-Shocked podcast. He talks Braves baseball, yep. Baseball in general, also some football and other things. Check him out. That's the Shell-Shocked podcast. We also have our friends Josh Brown and Ken Hendricks over at Nakahoma Nation. We are the podcast to be named later, the official podcast of Outfield Fly Rule. You can find us on Facebook at the Facebook page, Outfield Fly Rule. That's for news and updates and general information. You can also join the Facebook group for Outfield Fly Rule, where we engage in witty banter and snarky conversation with our Facebook friends. And again, that's the Facebook group. You can check us out on Twitter at OFR Sports. That's at OFR Sports, where you can see all the great articles written by Andy Harris and Micah Smith and Dylan Short and Dan Horton and Philip Tapley has joined us as well. Also, check out our friends over at Walk Off Walk. We're going to be hearing from them soon as well. That's it, folks. Appreciate you tuning in. We'll do this again with more practice. Have a good day, everybody.
Thanks for listening. It's good to be back.